Good morning. Good morning, Judge Bresson. May it please the court. Donald Falk for Appellant John Paul Mitchell Systems. Class certification cannot provide relief to class members that they couldn't obtain individually. That's why class-wide proof has to be truly class-wide. Now, this case tests how far assumptions can carry plaintiff's burden to show that class-wide issues predominate, how far assumptions can substitute for evidence of class-wide exposure or overcome evidence that class-wide materiality and hence reliance can't be proved class-wide, and also how far a court can assume that a not yet designed expert study that hasn't yet identified the principal and chosen the principal components of that study can provide class-wide proof of damages. Class certification cannot rest on so frail a foundation, and so the district court abused its discretion in certifying the class here. Now, this class certified assumes that all buyers of JPS products were misled by statements that many did not see and many did not care about because they were unrelated to the principal purchase of a hair care, principal purpose of a hair care product. Now, there's an inference, they rely on an inference that every buyer relied on these small statements on the side or back of the packaging, but you can't get to the inference of reliance until you pass the threshold of exposure, which the Downey case makes clear is an element just like deception and materiality. You can't be misled by something you never saw. Now, the district court assumed that every buyer would take a package, turn it around, turn it sideways to read these statements because when directed to the statements in open court, he found them visible enough. But that's not evidence, and it also doesn't say what actual consumer behavior is, and more importantly, it misses a legal premise that is well established in this court and in the California courts, where the courts do not assume that purchasers routinely read back labels. In fact, the Brady court said it's untenable to assume that a reasonable consumer reads the back label of a product, and it based that holding in part on this court's Williams v. Gerber decision that held that you can't expect a reasonable consumer to look at the side of a product.
Can I ask Mr. Falk just in terms of what the rule is that you're asking for? So are you saying that anytime the representation is on the back or the side label, there's no assumption of exposure?
Yes, that's the rule. There's no assumption of exposure. There may be other factors that lead a plaintiff to be able to show that. Plaintiff can come forward with evidence, but it puts the burden on the plaintiff to come forward with evidence that there's exposure. And here there was no evidence, and so you can't assume that showing was met.
So what would be the proof then? Some kind of expert that says when somebody buys these, they typically turn them around or something like that?
That would be one.
We don't ask for that in the front label context, whether rightly or wrongly, but the law seems fairly clear that, you know, if it's on the front label, we're going to treat you as having been exposed to it and having seen it.
Absolutely, Your Honor, because looking at the front label is a necessary part of the purchase process and practical inevitability, in the words of, I think it was Brady or it might have been Daniel.
Right, even though we know, though, that people don't often review labels when they buy something.
I mean, Your Honor, at least the leading cases, I mean, there are a lot of these cases, and I won't speak for every single one of them, but on the leading cases, it's often either part of the title of the product or something, you know, pretty prominent on the front. I mean, if you're buying, for example, in Brady, one-a-day vitamins, it's hard to say that nobody saw the one-a-day promise. And it's hard to say that anything else on the front hasn't been seen, but you can't assume. You might be able to prove. There might be a little arrow that points to something. I mean, there are many different types of packaging, but there's nothing like that here. Plaintiffs came forward with nothing at all. They just assumed because it's somewhere on the label, and you can find it if you look for it, that every consumer was exposed. And that does not meet the standard of actually viewing an alleged misstatement.
But back to the question of the rule you're asking for. So does it depend on the prominence of the label on the back or the side? In other words, if you had a back label where the entire back label was coded in this massive representation, would we be still having the same discussion, or would you be acknowledging there really should be a sort of assumption of exposure and a presumption of reliance?
Well, as I say, there may be fact-specific and label-specific factors that allow a plaintiff to carry the burden, but here the plaintiff did nothing and couldn't do anything because if you look at the frontal labels, there's absolutely nothing that makes you turn around to the back unless you're one of those people that always looks at the back or you're looking for something in particular. So, yes, I mean, it would be an easier case for them to prove that, but they still have to prove it. As I say, it might be pretty easy. But here, where you're looking at something that's pretty small, it's there. It's findable.
Right, but I mean, would you be making the same points if it was very big on the back, even without some direction on the front to turn to the back?
Well, the legal rule... Your Honor. Were you finished? Sorry about that.
Yeah, go ahead.
That's the rule, and, they'd say, well, wait, look at this. This is so much different that frankly, even if you dropped it into the shopping cart, you'd see this or something like that. It's something you have to show with evidence that there's a particular reason, as this court has held, that particular reason to turn the packaging around and read something. And sometimes there may be, but there's nothing here. And that's our point. There's the rule says they can't assume, and all they did was assume. And the Sebadol case makes it really clear. I think it's a very good rule. If it's an optional part of the purchase process, not something you have to look at, and here, of course, you couldn't possibly in some of the online representations, that might not even be shown, but you certainly would have to click through things to see it. If it's an optional part of the purchase process, plaintiff's got to put on some proof that everybody looked, and if plaintiff doesn't put on any proof, there's no proof of exposure.
Right, but I mean, do you think there's a difference between, like, Sebadol is like a website, purchase case. In fact, we're hearing argument in another case today, as you probably know, that presents issues like that. But here we have a case where we're talking about a label on the product, and it seems like the cases have treated that somewhat differently.
Well, I think the rule of Sebadol that if it's an optional part of the purchase process holds anywhere, and so it becomes again. It's not. I don't think it's a hard bar to certification ever. It just means that the plaintiffs have to come through with some reason that, the great mass of consumers are going to actually see the misstatements that they're suing over. If an individual said, well, I didn't see it, but I'm suing, of course we throw that person out of court. They wouldn't get past the first hurdle. But you can't sweep class members into a class merely by assumption in this case, where we have very strong statements by this court and the California courts that we don't assume that you look at the back. We don't say it's you can prove it, but you don't assume it.
Do we make any different kind of an assumption when we're dealing with things that are required to be on a label? For example, the contents on the back of something that's a consumable. If we're looking for protein content or added sugars or calories, that's usually found on the back. But that's also something that consumers are looking for and that they know is going to be there because it's required.
Well. I think, certainly when it's come to the defendant's benefit, the court has said, well, that some people are going to look there, some people aren't. So if you made your disclosure on that required back label, that's not good enough, at least without some real evidence that people looked at it. So I think the same rule has to apply both ways. But let me be clear, Your Honor, that might be the case, particularly if it's a supplement or something where I think it wouldn't be that difficult to show that lots and lots, great mass of people want to see what's in the supplement, you'd be able to make that case, but you can't just assume your way there. That's our point, Your Honor.
Paul Mitchell put this symbol on its products? Is it required to do so?
It's not required to do so.
Okay, so why does it do it? It feels like it kind of clutters things, right?
Well, I mean, it is... I'm not privy to the subjective reason. I do know that the company... has eschewed animal testing for a long, long time, and they put it out there.
Because they think that will be important to some people.
For some people, yeah, absolutely, Your Honor. We don't deny, and it would be silly to stand up
and that group is large enough that Paul Mitchell thinks it's important to put it on all of its products.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that go on the products that are important to some group, but that doesn't mean that it's important class-wide, and not at all. In fact, and that's the key here. The fact that it's important to some group, what was our possibility of raising, and we're moving to reliance here, raising a presumption of reliance by some people, absolutely, but this court has made very clear there's a difference between something that's important to some people and something that's important class-wide. And the court has said, this court has said repeatedly, quote, a statement, quote, is not material as to all class members. The issue of reliance would vary from consumer to consumer, and the class should not be certified, which it has said if there's a sizable portion of the class for which a statement is not material, you can't, the inference of reliance disappears. It said that in Little, it said that in Nui, and here, plaintiff's best evidence shows at least 29%, if not 40%, of consumers that were surveyed and women consumers that were surveyed do not find no animal cruelty-free, which is not even the right statement, cruelty-free ingredients to be important in their purchases. That's one out of three, and you can't just because something's important to some doesn't mean you can suddenly take a third of a class and sweep them in for relief that they couldn't possibly achieve on their own. And the district court was so focused on understanding of the statements that it didn't really deal with the materiality piece of Dr. Hansen's report that, you know, even if two-thirds were enough, and it's not because this court says a sizable portion or a large percentage that don't find something material automatically knocks out the inference. The court flipped that around as if a large percentage makes a conclusive presumption of reliance, which just isn't so. But even in rejecting Hansen's because he didn't talk about understanding, instead he talked about what plaintiffs complained about was whether a person was likely to purchase the product, i.e. materiality. The court said on page 4, someone who's staunchly opposed to animal testing would say that every form of animal testing is unacceptable, no matter what the representations by label or company, while someone with no problems with animal testing would say the opposite. Exactly so. There are distinct large portions of this class that cannot be swept into a presumption of reliance when it's been rebutted the way it has been here by their best evidence, not to mention Hansen's evidence that 2% made no animal testing an important factor.
Can I ask you about the damages piece?
Absolutely.
So the plaintiffs say, you know, after this appeal was filed, they have gone about trying to address some of the issues you've raised in discovery. And that's not before us, but what is the import of this argument if they now say they have come forward with more?
Well, the import is there's no import at all, Your Honor. In the Russoff case, this court made reasonably clear, and in some of the other cases, the one of our other 28J letters, court talked about the kind of gamesmanship where you don't show up with anything at class certification, and then when it's challenged, say, oh, we got something else in our back pocket. Of course, what they have hasn't been tested, but it's not relevant to the class certification decision. You have to prove class certification at the class certification stage. So it's not something to be considered here. What they can do with it on remand, if this course reverses and remands or vacates and remands, we think it should be reversed. But either way, it's going to go back. What happens to it there will be up to the district court. But what was happening here is just surfacing a couple generic models where the questions, variables, control analysis, data sets, attributes, levels, subject population, none of those were chosen yet. So how do you evaluate that under any standard of Daubert? I mean, it seems from Olean and Russoff that Daubert applies the normal way and the Ellis case that this court decided many, many years ago in the wake of Walmart. But even if it's watered down, how do you make a predictive judgment when all you have is a menu of options, a desired endpoint, and no way how to get there? An expert has to show how the model is going to work, not just tell. And he said, well, I can't really tell you that on page 411 until I do this qualitative and quantitative pre-survey analysis that he hadn't performed yet, might not perform, couldn't describe. I mean, he's selling a goat in a gunny sack, Your Honor. That's not enough to get to class certification. That's not charting a path. That's barely a gesture. And if I can save my last minute and 15 for a rebuttal. Any further questions obviously would come first. Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah, thank you. We'll put 2 minutes on the clock for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Michaela Crass, and I represent the Appellees. JPMS's argument is basically that this is not a typical class case, but this case is precisely the type of labeling case that is suitable for class action treatment, and it involves the type of harm the consumer protection statutes in California were meant to correct. During my opposing counsel's time, you asked him why JPMS put this on every label. And I think you can find that in their opening brief. In their opening brief, they say, in 1980, JPMS became the first professional beauty company to publicly take a stance against animal testing. This is a core belief of their company. Their president for 20 years testified to this. In accordance with that stance, it placed a no animal testing label on every bottle it sold. And plaintiffs, in their class certification motion, they presented significant evidence from which a jury could find that JPMS broke that promise by testing on animals for 20 years in China. Because there were uniform representations on every bottle establishing class-wide exposure, and JPMS's own internal documents show that JPMS's no animal testing representations was material to consumers, the district court properly certified a class of California consumers.
So I was asking Mr. Falk what rule he wanted. I guess I have the same question for you when it comes to these back or side label claims. So is it your position that any claim on a back or side label is treated essentially the same as a front label claim, and we give it an assumption of exposure?
Well, the case law really doesn't, when it talks about prominence, there's not a lot of cases that talk about how prominent the label is. There's some district court decisions that say, you know, prominence actually goes to materiality as to how prominent it was. I think I would agree that if it was buried in a back label, you know, buried inside a panel, buried in text, that maybe that wouldn't be enough for class-wide exposure. But in this case, you know, they want to say backside label. These are round bottles. The court found that it was pretty prominent. And if anything, where it's located on the product would go to the materiality issue, which would be decided by the jury. So the case law is very clear that class-wide exposure is presumed when the representation appears on every label. And the only question is whether it's material to a reasonable consumer. The court recently found that in Nuhi. You know, this is pretty much a bedrock legal principle.
Right. Certainly as to the front. And so I guess and I'm not aware of a case that said it's not true with respect to the back, but I guess that's sort of the question in the case, right? Would there be different reasons brought to bear on front versus back under the law?
There certainly is no case that says it's different when it comes to the front or the back. The cases that they cite regarding side or back label claims, those are all cases where the court is determining at the pleading stage whether the plaintiffs have simply stated a claim. And it's a simple rule that if it's unambiguous on the front, we're not going to look to the back at the pleading stage. It's up to the jury to decide this issue. There is just no case that says if it's on the side or the back, you cannot assume class-wide presumption. So class-wide exposure. So if this court wanted to make that rule, I think you would have to remand it back to the district court, because the district court was simply following what the cases say in this situation. On the materiality issue, I think materiality is judged by an objective, reasonable consumer standard. So it does not create a predominance issue. That's what the district court found. That's what many cases in this district have held. DZ Reserve most recently has found that. We didn't just rest on that assumption of materiality, though. We presented evidence, which was JPMS's own documents. And the court credited those documents, saying, look, you did this survey. It shows that 71 to 87% of users thought that the cruelty-free call-out was an important call-out. Certainly, they put in conflicting evidence. But again, both of those things go to the jury. And that's what Judge Chhabria said at the oral argument. He was like, look, I might not agree with your expert, but this is a question of fact for the jury. The jury's going to look at both sides, and it's going to be an issue that rises or falls together.
How about the damages piece of this, in terms of just how much work your expert had done up until the point this was certified?
Certainly. So he put forward two methods of two damages models. Not that he was going to do both, but he had an alternative damages model. His primary model was a hedonic regression. And the Judge Chhabria found that he did more than just gesture at a model, which is what Lytle says you can't do. You can't just gesture at a model. He described how the hedonic would work. He provided that hedonic regression. He provided some of the variables that he would look at and use. He couldn't finalize that because he didn't have the data. He identified for the court, these are the sources of data, but he needed that data to complete that hedonic regression. And you have to understand that this report was done in December of 2025, right? We didn't get our class certification order until June of the next year. And so...
Well, whose issue is that, I guess? Is that not your issue?
It's just simply that because this is an interlocutory appeal, the case was moving on, right? You know, we issued this report in December. We were still undergoing discovery. You know, we put forward a lot of evidence in this case to support our class certification motion, including his report, which I think is sufficient under Lytle. JPMS does not cite any case that says his report is that he has to do X to meet this standard, and they don't cite any case that says what he did is insufficient. They cite two cases specifically, which is the Bruton case and the Dole packaged food case. And the interesting thing about that case, both of those cases, that they involve the same expert, Dr. Capps. And in the Bruton case, one of the reasons the court decided to exclude that expert is because he had been excluded in other cases because he couldn't actually perform the hedonic regression. He was unable to isolate the price premium. Dole packaged foods, that case actually was a motion to decertify. The court had already found, okay, they put forth a methodology, let's go forward with this. And when he actually performed the hedonic, he couldn't isolate the price premium. And so the court looked at that and the fact that he had been excluded in other cases. And
how about this Boeing case that was brought to our attention out of the Fourth Circuit? That seems similar to what's happened here. I mean, just in my view, looking at this, is, you know, we're somewhat forgiving on the damages side of the house, but
yes,
there was not a whole lot done here as compared to other cases. Even compare, you know, maybe it's at that point now, but whether it was at that point at the time of class certification seems more doubtful.
Sure. Well, I think in, first of all, Boeing is obviously not precedent. You don't have to follow that here. I think Boeing, you know, approved Lytle, but I think part of this is, you know, it's not, it's, so JPMS likes to couch this as either undesigned versus unexecuted, and there's, or designed versus unexecuted. And there's nothing in the case law that says it has to be fully designed but not executed. And so this is an abuse of standard, the abuse of discretion standard that the district court made its findings. Is there any clear error here in how he made his findings? But I think even if you say, okay, he made an error here, this particular expert didn't do enough, the fact of the matter is that he has done that hedonic regression. We were less than 2 weeks away from Daubert motions. So JPMS was going to have an opportunity, which is what Lytle and Newhey says, is you have to give the defendant the opportunity to actually test the model once it's been executed, and they were going to get that opportunity.
So the Daubert motion, this is class cert, expert Daubert motion deadline is after the class is certified?
So actually, they filed a Daubert motion. That's the other piece here, is JPMS actually filed a Daubert motion on Dr. McCartney, and the court denied that motion. But the court also in the schedule, we have the opportunity to issue additional Daubert motions for the full expert reports. That was what was next up in our schedule, in our case schedule. So we had already, all of the parties had disclosed their full expert reports for the merits case, and we were less than 2 weeks away from actually filing Daubert motions on those full expert reports. So, you know, at worst, if you want to say, look, maybe this expert didn't do enough, I don't agree with that. But if you were to say that, I think the question is, we just remand it back to the district court to look at what he's done now, because he's done that full expert report.
I guess I'm getting a little confused on the due dates of different things, and it may not fully matter, but sure. But when were the expert reports on class cert were due, when in relation to the class cert hearing?
So the expert reports on class cert were due December 12th, 2024. So we issued Dr. McCartney's class certification report on that date. JPMS filed a Daubert motion on March 6, 2025, concurrent with our class certification motion. The court, granted the class certification motion in part and denied it in part on June 27th, 2025. And then in August 25th, 2025, we actually issued our merits expert reports, which included a full report from Dr. McCartney, as well as a survey expert, just to answer the survey expert that they had used at class certification.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
Something else that came up very briefly in the opening briefs that I want to raise is that there's a question on the UCC claim, and I think it's important to know that the UCC doesn't have the same standards as the California consumer protection claims. Reliance is not an element of the express warranty claim, and promises that appear on a package form the basis of the bargain. That comes from Weinstadt and Legrand are two of the cases that talk about that. I was a little surprised that JPMS argued that, oh, hey, Reliance is now required here. You know, they cited one case, which is a case that's been superseded by statute. But at the district court level, JPMS conceded to the district court that Reliance was not required. That's not in our brief, but the record site is 3ER457 note 6 and 3ER513. So the fact that we're kind of arguing about Reliance when it comes to the UCC here is a little surprising. But regardless of what we're talking about when it comes to class-wide exposure and materiality, I think that UCC claim was properly certified, you know, subject to, obviously, we have to have a damages report. But I think that's the only other point I have, unless you have additional questions for me.
It appears not.
Okay. I will rest there. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Briefly on express warranty, Your Honor, I turn to that page and we make an argument about what standard Reliance applies, because express warranty claims, as we pointed out in our reply brief where this was first engaged, it wasn't really engaged in the district court, there's a basis of the bargain requirement, and the majority of California courts, the large majority of California courts, have applied some basis of the bargain to require Reliance. And it's especially appropriate where you have something here that it's not part of the essence of the bargain. It's not part of the performance use expectations about a product. And whatever standard of Reliance applies, we have shown that it's individualized here. We've rebutted any presumption. And if the regular standard applies, which the majority of courts appear to do in the UCC, and Justice Eagleson in the Williams v. Beechnut opinion did apply that right before he went up, so persuasive, but obviously not binding, it's essentially the same test. Now, this court in Russoff and the Second Circuit in Bustamante made clear that, you know, what the seller thinks is not class-wide proof of what's important to buyers. And no animal testing, as I said, is very important to the JPMS's founder, and so it goes on there, and it's a narrowcasting kind of thing. It's not something that proves that all consumers care about it. And the best evidence, of course, shows that a third of the class doesn't care enough to make it an important part of their purchase process. And this court has made clear again and again, it's not a conclusive presumption of materiality. You show materiality as to some, that's not enough. If some portion, in the words of Nui, of the class did not find it material, the presumption disappears. And then you've got to prove Reliance, which, of course, gets rid of class cert. Finally, on the and class-wide proof, whether it's class-wide proof, it's not a jury issue. That's a court issue. Always has been, always will be, the class cert stage. On the expert, the facts are undisputed. It's very, very simple to see what he did or didn't do. We can argue. It's a very few pages because he did so little, and he admitted in a very few pages of deposition that he didn't do anything. This is a menu of options, if that, because you hardly even know what the options are going to be. But even looking at what he did say, I mean, just looking at what he said he would calculate a single price per ounce premium on products that range in price from 10 cents an ounce to $2.50. that alone is enough to, as a, I think as a matter of law, and showing what a regression would show as an issue for abuse of discretion under Olean, it's not a fact question. That's enough to say this couldn't get you over the hump here. I mean, this case, the class certification rested on a lot of legally invalid assumptions that were not supported by evidence, not the availability of class-wide proof, which is the kind of evidence you need, as this court has made clear many times and as the Supreme Court has made clear many times, and so it should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Fogg. Ms. Cross, we appreciate the helpful briefing and argument. This case is submitted. We'll take a brief recess.